Okay, let's turn in the Institutes to Book 1, Chapter 5. And I'm fairly certain that we left off right around Section 4. I want to back up. We were in a hurry last time as we ended. We had talked about Calvin's argument that infants, and just the way infants come into this world able to benefit from their mother's breast milk, is a testimony to God, and the crying of infants, inarticulate though it be, gives praise to God and should shame us for the fact that our philosophers don't do better in coming to a knowledge of God. At the very end of Section 3, I do think this one sentence is worthy of comment as far as the distinctives of Calvin's own theology and hopefully of Calvinists today as well. Calvin says, "Indeed, no one gives himself freely and willingly to God's service unless, having tasted his fatherly love, he is drawn to love and worship him in return." Calvin's theology, and certainly Calvin's followers, have often been misconstrued. The impression, I guess, has somehow been given or has come across that people can be compelled into the kingdom of God, that there's, you know, this predestinarian God of justice, and that men must cower before him, and even if they don't feel real good about it, they are under obligation to submit to the summons of the gospel and become Christians. And I, for whatever technical or legal truth there may be in that, that there's an obligation, Calvin doesn't teach this. He doesn't teach that men can simply, by looking at the justice of God or the greatness of God and his excellence, be driven to him, that they must first taste of his fatherly love, that men do not worship God properly in a begrudging fashion. They do not worship God properly, even if they have mental notions which are correct, unless they have hearts that have been touched by his love. Men do not give themselves freely and willingly to God's service unless they perceive him as a heavenly Father, not just as the artificer of the universe, the one who made all things, not just as the great lawgiver, as it were, not simply as the eternal judge, but as a heavenly Father. And from time to time I'll stop to point these things out, because not that Calvin's theology needs to be softened, it just needs to be understood. Okay, now we come to Section 4, which is entitled, "But Man Turns Ungratefully Against God." And here in the opening sentence, Calvin speaks of the foul ungratefulness of men. The foul ungratefulness of men. Romans 1:21 is what he's referring to, where Paul says that men, though they knew God, did not worship him as God, but became vain in their reasonings, and their senses were darkened. And this little phrase is put in there that we sometimes, as apologists, tend to jump over and not pay a lot of attention to, but it's of real dynamic, spiritual, personal importance. Neither gave thanks. The three words. Neither gave thanks. And it's in this foul ungratefulness of men that Calvin finds the source of their distress, that they now must, not being grateful for the mercies of God and how his power has been displayed to them, taking care of their lives and showing his greatness in creation and so forth, that not being grateful for all of this, they are led to have vain reasoning. The source of unbelief, the source of man seeking to flee from God, is that he is not grateful to a heavenly Father for all that he has done. And I won't stop to wax long and eloquent and preach to you, but I mean, this really is preachable material. Just stop and think about it. Isn't that what's wrong with the people around about us? Isn't that why it's so hard to evangelize them and get them to open their hearts? It's because they just aren't grateful. They take so much for granted. I take so much for granted. I mean, I have days when I just want to kick myself for not stopping to think, look at what God has given us. Look at what God has done for us. And then we stop and we squander our emotions and fret about little things that get in the way. And they're not little, I guess, at the moment. They don't seem that way. But you put them in context, they certainly are. Now, Calvin says, when we let our minds get so clouded that we won't be grateful to God, then we aren't going to think properly about him. In the middle of the paragraph that I've just read from, He says they are compelled to know, whether they will or not, that these are the signs of divinity. That's an interesting line that manifests that for Calvin, men know things even against their will. Men can know things against their will. Imagine for a moment a father. There's something very dreadful happened, not a pleasant illustration to be sure. But let's say he's in a hurry to get to work and he's backing his car down the driveway hurriedly, and without him knowing it, one of his little children was behind his car, and he kills one of his own children in his haste. Now, this sort of thing has been known to happen where psychologists or counselors deal with the people and they will be in such a state of mind they refuse to acknowledge that such a thing could have happened. People do that. They refuse to look squarely at the ugliness or the tragedy of what happened. There have been widows at the time who just get into great mental distress, refusing to believe that their husbands have died when they have. And this is very sad. But it does show us in a more or less mundane, that is to say, outside of the religious sphere, it does show us that knowledge and will are related to each other. They are not somehow in separate compartments. And Calvin, long ago, was on to that. Calvin said, men know things, whether they will to or not. They may not be willing to know, and yet they still know it. He says they're compelled to know it, because there are these signs of divinity, and yet they conceal them within. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness, as Paul would tell us. It says, even today the earth sustains many monstrous spirits who, to destroy God's name, do not hesitate to misdirect all the seed of divinity spread abroad in human nature. How detestable, I ask you, is this madness, that man, finding God in his body and soul 100 times, on this very pretense of excellence, denies that there is a God. And so Calvin is greatly distressed that people have no excuse for not knowing God and giving him credit for who he is and what he has done, and yet they do so. They set God aside, the while using nature, which for them is the artificer of all things. Now you're going to see two specific things that really rankle Calvin as he looks at the world, and properly, I mean, it should us too. And that's that men substitute nature for God and chance for providence. Or fortune, fate, for providence. We get into that in our reading today as well. But right now, this first one, Calvin says that this is just obscene, that men have all these things happen about them and all these evidences, and yet they set God aside using nature for their God. We, in the late 20th century, have not escaped the nature cult. I think back a few years, especially of the kind of latent pantheism in John Denver's songs, you know, about this natural high. We just get out there in the world or get our hands dirty with, you know, the dirt of a farm or something, that just getting back to nature in some grand way makes us better human beings and in touch with the source of all bounty and beauty and goodness and that sort of thing. And it seems to me also in political movements, this back to nature idea, anything that is artificial, you know, that's nuclear, you know, must be terrible. And men can, even priding themselves in what seems to be noble, that they're worshiping something beyond themselves or trying to do good for others by returning to nature. Nevertheless, Calvin would have found this deplorable. He just said the issue is whether you get back to God, not to nature.
John Denver even said that man was a poison upon the earth or something like that.
Yeah.
Remember that one?
Yeah. Scars, I remember the sentiment.
The scars upon the land, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so that we are unnatural, and nature, of course, is natural and the source of all good. And I don't know, I think as Christians, there's a temptation for us to say, well, boy, what a relief to hear something like that apart from this, you know, really tin shallow atheism and anti-supernaturalism and secularism that are all about us, at least you're somebody who has kind of a, quote, religious feeling about them. But Calvin doesn't brook any of that. Calvin says that's just as irreligious as all the rest, because it substitutes something in the place of God. He says that the evidences that he's been looking at, by the way, I'm on page 56, if any of you are having difficulty. Pretty soon we're going to need to turn that light on, I think, if we're going to be able to read. He says that these evidences bear upon the face of them a divinity that does not allow itself readily to be hidden. Bear upon the face of them a divinity. And the reason I bring up that particular line, and I'm going to be doing this a lot, we have to say tonight, it's going to center on this aspect of interpreting Calvin. There's a real controversy as to whether Calvin believed in the use of theistic proofs, or rather, whether he didn't rather look upon the natural world as giving direct and immediate evidence of God. And I would say that this line here certainly supports the latter interpretation. He talks about things which bear upon the face of them a divinity. What he's saying is not that you have to look at something, then draw an inference, and finally come to the conclusion there's a God. He says right on the surface of it, it bears it right on the face of the matter that there is this God. And then at the end of section 4 here, he has something which is of great interest to me because of my study in philosophy. He has this challenge to the philosophers. He says, first, to establish that there's something organic in the soul. Oh, okay, forget that sentence. The next one, let Epicurus answer what concourse of atoms cooks food and drink, turns part of it into excrement, part into blood, and begets such industry in the several members to carry out their task as if so many souls ruled one body by common counsel. Calvin knows the philosophy of Epicurus. Epicurus was an atomist, okay, and he believed that everything in the world is atoms falling through space, okay, and that everything follows the same rules, the same natural rules. So everything's made of the same thing, atoms. Everything's governed by the same mechanical laws. And so Calvin says, he asks this question, okay, let Epicurus answer. How is it if everything is made of the same and everything's just atoms falling through space subject to mechanical laws, why is it that some of these atoms cook the food, some eat the food, some turns part into excrement, some into blood, some gives energy to carry out tasks, and these tasks are different, and yet there's just one common purpose in the life of a man. But I like that attitude. Let Epicurus answer. All right, Epicurus, you Epicureans, let's see what you have to say about this. Calvin was not a shy and retiring sort who felt that, you know, we just do our best to give a witness, you know, this kind of testimony that is, well, I can't answer your problems. I can just tell you what Jesus has done for me. Well, there's value in saying what Jesus has done for me. But Calvin was not the kind that would just leave it at that. He said, okay, Epicurus, I have my problems for you to answer, too. Apologetics was not simply defensive, it was offensive, not offensive in the nasty sense. That is, it went on the offense. It went after them. And now, who do you figure is Calvin's mentor here?
Oh, there. I'm sorry. I was thinking in modern times who seems to have taken.
Well, let's go that way, too. Then we'll go back.
I think Van Til is
who did that. Oh, yeah. Van Til. Precisely. Van Til, well, I think it's typified in the title of one of his little pamphlets that I read early on when I was studying, and it always has kept its impression over me, and that's entitled The Intellectual Challenge of the Gospel. The Intellectual Challenge of the Gospel, where Van Til doesn't conceive of us as being out there just doing our best to parry all these different things and to volley, you know, the attack back. And
we have the ball in our hands.
That's right. Van was saying, boy, you'd better come up with an answer. What are you going to do? How are you going to account for this, you know? And it's taking the battle to the unbeliever. Now, let's ask, in Van Til's case, in Calvin's case, who is their mentor in this? Who does this sound like, Steve?
Augustine.
Well, Augustine. Thank you, right.
A little further back.
Let's see if we can go a little further back to Paul. Okay, what passage? Acts 17, he does challenge the Epicurean Stoic philosophers. And after he leaves Athens, he goes to Corinth and later writes a letter to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 for these stirring words. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Hasn't God made foolish the wisdom of this world? We could do far worse than to take a number of weeks in all of our churches and just go over and just ask people, just look at you. Look at the world right about you. What's the world saying? Study existentialism for a minute. Study theater of the absurd for a minute. Study this, study that, and just ask yourself, where is the wise? I mean, there's a lot of vaunted wisdom and arrogance at our universities. Those of you who've been at the university know that. Those who are in contact with people from the university know that. I certainly know that from my graduate studies. But the fact of the matter is, secular world hasn't got anything to offer today. They have really run out of options. And so my guess is in our day and age, pretty much we're going to see a recycling of old ideas, naturalism, and not existentialism. That's pretty much, you know, had it. But there'll be kind of a return to a latent kind of Kantianism and the structuralists of our day and so forth and so on. But the world today is in terrible shape intellectually, and always is, really. And Calvin and Paul, Van Til, whoever you look at here, they're following Paul's lead. And they say, okay, let Epicurus answer. Let's see what you can say in answer to our problems. Well, I'm going to take too long here, but I don't hurry up. Confusion of creature with creator. In this next section, Calvin deals with Aristotle's view as it destroys the immortality of the soul. And I'm not going to give a lot of detail on this. Aristotle taught that the soul, or the life force, the vitalizing aspect of man, was, how should I put it, coterminous with his body. That is to say, man is not a soul that has come into this world and taken on a body. Man is not a soul that's been entombed in a body. Now, who held that view? Plato, exactly. Plato's view is that we have a pre-existent life, and the soul now comes into the world and gets encased or entombed in a body. And actually, the Pythagoreans held this view before Plato, and it has a illustrious, infamous background. It's a common Greek view of man. So there you have the dualistic view of man, but you see it's a sad dualism. It's two things that don't belong together being forced into union with each other, the soul being put into this body. The other Greek view of man, the naturalist view of man, is found in Aristotle and others like the atomists and Epicureans. And that view was that man, and this is the prevailing view today, I would say, in secular circles in our own age, that man's soul or mind, to put it more technically, the jargon of our day, man's soul or mind is nothing different than his brain. It isn't as though man has a brain, but also has a mind which uses the brain, an immaterial thing. But it's rather that mind and brain are just the same thing, and we've been misled to talk about them in different ways, but they amount to the same thing. Now, Aristotle held that view, and Calvin wants to change that. He wants to challenge that, excuse me. And how does he do that? How do you, how does Calvin attack this idea of Aristotle? This view that binds the soul to the body so that it may not subsist without it. That is, when man dies, when the organic body dies, there is no soul or mind that goes on, or personality that goes on. Well, he says, yet the powers of the soul are far from being confined to functions that serve the body. Of what concern is it to the body that you measure the heavens, gather the number of the stars, determine the magnitude of each, know what space lies between them, with what swiftness or slowness they complete their forces, how many degrees this way or that they decline? I confess indeed that astronomy has some use, but I am only showing that in this deepest investigation of heavenly things, there is no organic symmetry, but here is an activity of the soul distinct from the body. As I understand it, and you correct me, you've read it, and you give me your impressions if they're different from this. As I see it, Calvin's arguing this way, that if the mind or if the soul is no different than the body or the specifically the brain, the organic functions, then we should find nothing associated with the mind except that which can be accounted for by organic need. Okay? If why does my mind contemplate the stars and all these irrelevant matters like the stars varying from one degree to another if it doesn't affect my body? I mean, what natural need has given rise to that kind of thinking? And so what he's trying to argue is for the freedom of the mind and the creativity of the mind apart from natural necessity. Did anybody get a different impression of this argument? Is that the way you take what he's trying to say?
The mind is concerned with bodily things. I see Aristotle.
That's right. Well, it's concerned for bodily things, but for more than bodily things, and why would it be if it's only a bodily function?
On Aristotle's terms, it should be only concerned with
bodily things. And so Calvin is saying, if Aristotle's right, if P, then Q. But Q is not true, therefore P is not true either.
What did Aristotle think that the soul or mind did upon death?
It expired along with the body. Except that this must be borne in mind that, in a sense, Aristotle has a view of a world soul, God. And that which animates us and lives within us is something of a splice off the block of divinity. And what happens is not so much that the soul lives on in the Christian sense, or that the soul lives on in a Pythagorean or Platonic sense, but rather the soul just gets reunited with the well of being, or God, from which it comes. What's that? Kind of like that. Life force. God is that. And it's very strange, the cosmology you get in Aristotle. Remember, God has nothing to do with the universe. But that which is in us that tends toward God is God, too. And especially in medieval Muslim thought, you have this idea of an oversoul taken from Aristotle, and the idea that you don't have a separate soul from me. We're just sharing the same current, as it were. And we're both plugged in to AC or DC or whatever.
By the force.
Yeah, or the force be with you.
But the Christian view would be more of a Platonian view, then.
Here's a real decisive yes and no, I would say to that. In one sense, the Christian view is close to Aristotle, in that we don't really hold that the soul is a ghost within a machine. We do believe that man is a unity, and Aristotle at least had that. On the other hand, with Plato, we would say that the soul has a life apart from the body. But we wouldn't say that it is apart from the body in the way that Plato did, or wouldn't despise the body the way Plato did. And so there's some aspects of truth, elements or reflections of truth in Plato, also in Aristotle. And the Christian view, I really think, is somewhat in between them. Most Christians, I should say, have a Platonic view of the soul, though.
Yeah.
Most Christians have the idea that the soul is a ghost in a machine, and it's really dreadful. We need to get away from this evil body and go to heaven. So we'll talk more about this.
The idea to promote suicide, huh?
Well, promote suicide of a cultural sort, if not of a personal sort, because what we say is we can renounce the physical world. And, of course, if we have any interest in physical things, I mean, far be it from any Christian to think that sex is good, or that money, you know, can be used for godly purposes, or that we should be out there, and that we can really have a Christian calling as farmers or as merchants or something. That comes with the Platonic view, I think. And you wouldn't have that. Of course, the Aristotelian view wouldn't allow for that, would it? The Aristotelian view would say, no, all of this is part and parcel of the life of man.
It would be very communal.
Very what?
Communal. How could there be individuality?
And of course, we do get that in the Middle Ages. We get well, not just in the Middle Ages, Renaissance on too, a kind of we share one life spirit and therefore we should share all things. And I'd especially like to share your Mercedes-Benz, but there is that possibility. But what I'm saying is that the Aristotelian view is more conducive to sacralizing all of life, saying everything in life has its sacred dimension. All of life is one, as it were, and for us that means religious. All of life is religious. In the Platonic view, you have a tendency to bifurcate life into that which is mental and part of meditation or part of godliness, and then those things which are bodily and historical and are just there as necessary evils. So, anyway, it's hard to choose, and gladly we don't have to choose between these people. Now Calvin, in section 5, goes on to say something about man showing the signs of immortality and certain mental abilities he has. And the only reason I'm going to pause here is because I want you to have a respect for this man. I mean, I'm going to disagree with him on things too, but it's amazing to me how much of modern philosophy is in one way or another anticipated. Calvin gives an argument here that sounds very much like Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre's not arguing for the living and true God, as you know. But Sartre wants to argue that man is glorious because he is a nothingness. Now, what does Sartre mean by a nothingness? Well, he distinguishes between two kinds of being, being in itself and being for itself. A rock is being in itself. Nothing can be done. I mean, it's there. But being for itself makes choices and does things. Well, that means that it fights against being in itself. Being for itself is not restricted, it's not pinned in, it's not held back by being in itself. Well, how can that be? Well, it must not have being then. Being for itself must be the same as nothingness, says Sartre. Now, all of this begins to sound like a real word game to most people, and well, to me as well. And in the end, I would criticize it for that. But then here's how Sartre proves that man is a nothingness. Man can nothing the world. Now, it's a strange use of the verb nothing. How does man nothing the world? He imagines things that aren't the case. Being in itself can't do that. But I can imagine, here we are, we're sitting in my front room, but I can imagine that I'm in Hawaii enjoying the rays of the sun right now. That's contrary to all truth, contrary to being. Things are not that way. That's not the way things be, if you don't mind me converting our language. That's not the way things be, but I can think of it that way. And that shows that I am not just a natural object. I have a power which goes beyond that. I must be being for itself. By the way, he ends up saying, being the pagan that he is, that this being for itself makes man the being who strives to become God. Whereas Calvin looks at the same thing and he says, that doesn't that show us that there is a God who has made us? Notice this. Calvin says, I'm about 10 lines down on page 57, manifold indeed is the nimbleness of the soul with which it surveys heaven and earth, joins past the future, retains in memory something heard long before, nay, pictures to itself whatever it pleases. Manifold also is the skill with which it devises things incredible, and which is the mother of so many marvelous devices. These are unfailing signs of divinity in man. He goes on to say, in the fact that man even thinks while he sleeps, the signs of immortality, that our life is not tied down to what is the case and what we actually experience. We can imagine amazing things. Fairy giraffes with butterfly wings. I've never seen a fairy giraffe with butterfly wings, but I put this thing together. I remember something from long ago. I can pretend something in the future is going to happen. And that nimbleness of mind is evidence that God has made us and has endowed us with certain abilities for which we should give him thanks, according to Calvin's theology. On page 58, right below the quote from Virgil, isn't it? Yeah, quotes Virgil at some length, and he says, "See of what value to beget and nourish godliness in men's hearts is that jejune speculation about the universal mind which animates and quickens the world, Calvin refers to that theory I just talked about, this idea of a universal mind that quickens the world, gives it life. Calvin loses his patience now in the next sentence and speaks of that filthy dog Lucretius. Oh, it's hard, though, if you've studied ancient philosophy, to get down on Calvin's language. Lucretius was a filthy dog. He really was. I mean, the kind of divinity or deity, and said that the course of nature is good in itself. And, of course, as Schaeffer has said, if what is good, that is, if naturalism is true, then the Marquis de Sade was right. You know, what is what should be. And since men are stronger than women, men can abuse women, and that's good. Well, Lucretius may not have drawn those conclusions, but you see, his philosophy certainly is foundational to them. And so Calvin calls him a filthy dog. He gets upset again here, this idea that nature is God. He says, rather, nature is the order prescribed by God. Nature is the order prescribed by God. And you want to remember that for future discussions when the word nature comes up. For Calvin, nature is the order that God prescribes. Nature doesn't run on its own then, but it is rather the way we see the orderliness of how God is running things. That's what he means by nature.
So the creature's kind of like Darwin, similar?
Not necessarily in his views of origins, but in his views of the natural world, yes.
The viciousness.
Yeah. Okay, here's your quiz for the evening. Calvin says in section 6, nothing is more preposterous than... You fill in the blank. Of course, you have your books in front of you. Everybody gets it right today. But, you know, when a writer says something like that, except, well, there are certain that I have read, some of my friends even, who tend to make everything, you know, an overstatement. But Calvin here is very strongly stating something. Nothing is more preposterous than to enjoy the very remarkable gifts that attest the divine nature within us, and yet to overlook the author. The most preposterous and ungrateful thing in the life of men is to enjoy the gifts of God and not give him credit, to overlook him. Why has he given us these manifestations? That he might draw us to contemplate him. God hasn't given us the beauty of the world or our natural abilities just so that we could pay attention to those things, but rather that we should be led beyond them to him. Calvin gives an example now of the mighty power of God, and this is really a very nice piece of literature, even in the English. Now he speaks of the world being subject to destruction, how God quiets the waves of the sea, and that sort of thing. And now I do need to stop and criticize Calvin in passing, painfully. And the editor has already done it, so I won't dwell on it at length. Footnote 23 tells you about Calvin's, what he calls it, traditional cosmology. I would call it an outdated cosmology. Calvin does argue, and I've checked this in his commentary on Genesis, it is there, the quote is very exact. He does say that because water is an element, it must be circular. I have no idea what that means, that water is circular. But he goes on to say that because water is lighter than air and heavier than air and lighter than earth, that it ought to cover the entire earth. That there is something of a cosmological argument that the whole earth ought to be covered by water. And it's only by a special providence of God that he heaps up the water, as the psalmist says, and keeps it in a particular place. Okay, and this is not a terribly good scientific understanding.
He's arguing based on densities.
Huh?
That the earth ought to submerge underneath the water because the earth...
Yeah, that's nobilizing the argument somewhat. That's a poor argument, and it comes from an ancient cosmology and understanding of the world. However, we are going to see in a minute that ancient cosmology, or cosmology in Calvin's day, isn't as bad as many people think. They understood that the world was round, was a sphere, and all that. And And Plato understood that too. We're going to say it just a minute. But anyway, so Calvin's outdated cosmology does need to be noted, to be honest here. Now, just below the middle of page 59, he says, "Now I have only wanted to touch upon the fact that this way of seeking God is common both to strangers and to those of his household." That is, looking at the almighty power of God displayed in the universe, Calvin says all men should be led to understand that they are made by God, that he is the creator. And he says this way of seeking God, this path of evidence leading to God, is common to strangers as well as those who belong to the household of God. Now, this would stand very starkly over against the thinking of someone like Karl Barth in our day. Karl Barth maintains that nature is worthless as an evidence to God, and that there is not only no natural theology, but no natural revelation worth anything. He says the only way people see God in nature is if they first begin by having had a personal encounter with God. And so he's against all what might be considered apologetic argumentation from the natural world. And Calvin wasn't, and though we are accused of it by some people, the presuppositionalists who follow Calvin are not that way either. Calvin says this way of seeking God is common to strangers as well as those who belong to the household of God. But now let's look at something, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. This sentence, which says, "This very might," the power of God in calming the seas, etc., "this very might leads us to ponder his eternity. For," and now here comes the argument, "he from whom all things draw their origin must be eternal and have beginning from himself." Okay, now that may seem to some people to be an argument that says everything comes from something, that something from which everything comes from nothing, and must be God, must be eternal. Let's read it again. "He from whom all things draw their origin must be eternal and have beginning from himself." What I want to ask you is whether this is a form of the cosmological argument. Is this what Calvin is attempting to do? Can somebody remind us what the cosmological argument is? Steve?
If I remember right, this argument that says that in fact, this one is attributed to Aristotle, that everything has a cause, a beginning. And if you follow the beginning to the last cause, that's God, our unmoved mover, whatever.
Yeah, although Steve has gotten it just the opposite in terms of terminology. Not last cause.
First cause. Right.
First cause, right. Exactly.
Ultimate.
That's right. The ultimate first cause of all things. Okay, everything comes from something, or everything is caused by something, and therefore there must be a first cause for God. I'm going to talk first about the cosmological argument, then I'm going to talk about whether Calvin did this, was attempting to do this. Where did the world come from? A natural question people ask, children ask, and the answer which is proposed is, well, the cause of the world is God. Every event has a cause, and there must be a first cause that started the whole chain of causes and events going. Every event has a cause. Everything has a cause. Well, if all events in nature have causes, does that entitle us to demand that the cause for nature as a whole transcends nature? Immanuel Kant put that question very effectively. He said, how do we know every event has a cause? Well, we know it from looking at the natural world. Well, how is it by looking at instances of natural causality, we have the right to transcend nature and speak of a cause. You see, the causal principle, as Kant recognized in the argument, is something we learn about nature. So how can you apply it outside of nature, which is what you have to do when you talk about the whole of nature? If I had a blackboard, it's a very easy way of seeing this. We have a lot of instances, you know, of an effect, okay? I drop the basketball, it bounces, okay, it falls down. And you know, when I poke somebody with a pen, they say, ouch, and all that. Well, we have all these cases, all right? But they're all within the context of what? The natural world. We see causation working. Now, if I want to take that bracketed area and talk about something causing it, all of it, including the basketballs and the pens and babies being born and trees growing and all the things that have cause and effect about them, if I want to take that and say, now, what causes it? What I'm really doing is expanding what I call the natural world. I'm pulling the bracket back and saying a principle that I found operative within the bracket, I want to apply to the bracket. But every time I apply it to the bracket, in order to make that legitimate, I have to pull the bracket back further. I have to expand the blackboard, because what I'm saying is I'm using a natural principle, which is to say I just keep expanding nature, 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 and you never can get beyond nature. Kant, you see, points this out. The cosmological argument is only good if you want to prove that God is part of the natural world. A supernatural God cannot be proved by a principle that's restricted to natural operations. Well then, instead of treating the causal principle as an empirical or natural principle pertaining to the sensible world, many philosophers have said we need to treat it as a metaphysical demand of reason. A metaphysical demand. It's not something that we've learned from the natural world, but reason demands that everything have a cause. When the old apologist just kind of flips back on his chair at that point, he goes, oh no. If it's a metaphysical principle that everything have a cause, then the question is God part of what exists? Is God a metaphysical object? It may be impious to call him an object, but metaphysics deals with that which is real. Is God real? Yes. Well, now you said it's a principle that everything that's real has a cause. And so now the child's question has no answer, all right? Mommy, where did I come from? Well, you came from Mommy and Daddy in a way that we'll explain later, okay? Well, where did Mommy and Daddy come from? Okay, and then where did the world come from? It came from God. And then finally, what's the child in? Where did God come from? See, if it's a metaphysical principle, then it applies to everything that's real. And then you do have an infinite regress. He goes on and on and on asking, where did each thing come from? Schopenhauer, the philosopher, was a pessimist, by the way, both in personality as well as philosophical teaching, said that the cosmological principle should not be used as a taxi to be dismissed at will. You know, once we've gotten to where we want to go, then we just the taxi, don't we? Well, some religious people take the cosmological principle till it gets to God, and they say, okay, thanks, we're glad, see you later. They dismiss the cosmological principle. Schopenhauer said, then what right do we have to do that? The cosmological principle, if applied consistently, should lead us now to asking God, where did you come from? All right, so if you take the cosmological or causal principle as a natural principle, then it can't be used to prove a supernatural God. And if it's used as a metaphysical principle, then it's only special pleading inconsistency that keeps us from going on to ask, now, where did God come from? There are other problems with the cosmological argument. One is a problem that hopefully any beginning student of quantified logic would about. To say there is a cause for each phenomena. Okay, there's an apple over here, and a little baby over here, and there's a Chevrolet car over here. Each one of them has a cause, right? To say that there is a cause for each phenomena is not to say, it's not the same thing as saying there is a cause for every phenomena. each and every, you see. Many people don't understand the distributive use of the word every as each. Okay, there's a cause for every person in this room, right? You had parents, and 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 I've had parents. I still do. And so that means we all have the same parents, right? To say that there are parents for every individual, for each individual, is not to say there's one set of parents for every. What I'm getting at here is, when somebody says, from the causal principle we can prove God, what we should say, just as a point of mathematical or quantification logic, well, what we can say is there are a lot of gods. You can't prove that there's only one God from the causal principle. The universe, obviously, could consist of an infinite series of temporally overlapping entities. Ever thought about that, of a causal chain? This particular universe or galaxy has been caused by, you know, a certain distribution of matter and that sort of thing, and that will go out of existence and will lead to another kind of physical situation, which will lead to another one, which will eventually bring us back to this one again. But they're not all simultaneous. It's just a chain of events that goes on for billions and billions and zillions and what are the numbers higher than that? I'm not good at this. But I mean, yeah, way beyond our comprehension, the universe could just keep going in this way too. Why can't we say that everything comes from something, but what it comes from is physical? It's just matter, over and over and over again, in different states and different forms, but it's matter. That is, why can't we just say, instead of God, the universe as a whole, and then worship the physical world? And so, either the cosmological argument retains its empirical impetus, and God becomes part of the natural realm, or we treat God's relationship to the world as transcendent and mysterious, and thus we lose the empirical impetus of the cosmological argument, and all claims that the world and somehow depends on God, and we can see this from the causal principle. Now, what I've given you here is just a very, very brief, but I hope effective, refutation of the use of the cosmological argument outside of a presuppositional framework. Let's go back and look at Calvin. He's the reason we brought all this up. What'd Calvin say? He from whom all things draw their origin must be eternal and have beginning from himself. If Calvin is meaning to argue at this point, it's a very bad argument. And it creates all the problems that we've already talked about. I want to suggest, however, that maybe he's not arguing and he's doing something else. He's pointing out something that's true by definition. That if you begin with a certain concept, you just have to appreciate the logic or the thrust, the significance of that concept itself. Here's the concept. God is the one from whom all things draw their origin. God is the one from whom all things draw their origin. And what Calvin is saying, he's not arguing everything has a cause and therefore God must be the cause of all things. He's saying, since God is the cause of all things, he can't be caused. And the sense doesn't have the force of an argument from premise to premise. It has the force of explicating what I mean when I say God is the origin of all things. God's the source of everything, and therefore God can't have his own source, because he's the source of everything else. But the barber of Seville shaves all those who do not shave themselves. All right? So now we ask, does the barber of Seville shave himself? And we can get some cutesy little logical problems, because if you say, well, he doesn't shave himself, but the statement is that he shaves all those who don't shave themselves, so if he doesn't shave himself, he does. I mean, that's one of the things this can be used for. But I want to illustrate something else. When we say the barber of Seville shaves all those who don't shave themselves, if we're going to be understood logically, naturally exclude the barber of Seville from the description. If God is the origin of all things, we must exclude God from the description. He doesn't have an origin. And I want to maintain that's what Calvin's doing here. And that this does not give support to our Calvinistic brothers who want to be evidentialists and apologetics, that Calvin used the cosmological argument. I'd rather say, Calvin says we all know that God's the source of everything, and so we must know that God's eternal because he can't have a source if he's the source of everything else. Well, I've talked on and on and on. If you want to dispute that or go back and have me explain something, I'll be glad to do that.
Well, how does Calvin handle the question then, the origin of God?
I think what Calvin is saying is God doesn't have an origin because we see that he's the source of everything. And that is not so much an argument as it is the explication of a notion. That is laying out of what we mean by saying God's the source of everything. If he's the source of everything, then he doesn't have a source. And if he doesn't have a source, that is to say he must be eternal.
That's what I was going to say. Gets to the argument of eternity.
Well, it shows what Calvin says is that the very concept of a God who is not made by anything else, the very concept of a God who is the source of all other things, entails, in and of itself, that God is eternal. Because if he's not eternal, he had to come from something. But we've already said he doesn't come from anything.
Does eternal mean beyond human comprehension? Is that just about all it means?
No, I would say that what is eternal probably is beyond human comprehension, but that isn't what we mean by eternal. Eternal means without beginning or end.
Well, could he be saying here that since it's obvious that the universe in itself is eternal, therefore the God who created it must be eternal too?
No, I think because he says the universe must come from something, must have its source in God.
But if you consider the universe in terms of each of its component parts, which I guess exist at different times.
Yeah. Then it might be eternal.
Yeah, because you see these things, they change their form, they still exist. And since the universe is eternal, then the God who continually causes it, I guess, must be eternal as well.
Yeah, except in Calvin's mind, he would say that if the universe is eternal, it doesn't need an origin.
I don't think Calvin argues that it is eternal. In fact, I think his argument more is that it is created and hence beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking more, though, in the sense of continuing on forever and not so much
vastness to me,
not so much in the past.
Vastness and size?
No, eternity, future.
Yeah, I got you that way.
To some point in the past, at least.
Yeah, but Calvin is thinking about origin, and so that's to the past rather than to the future, but I see what you're saying.
The way you use the word eternal is not the way it's always used, because we have life eternal, but we do have a beginning point. You said that...
Yeah, eternal, I meant in the case of God, meant without beginning and without end, but we have... You see, that's why I've always felt that it's better to say everlasting life rather than eternal life. Mm-hmm. Common custom in Christian circles speaks of eternal life, but I should rather think that what we have is life that once begins will always last. Mm-hmm. It goes on into the future, everlastingly.
It doesn't speak to eternity past.
Yeah, but our life doesn't go back to
the past. We're eternity as in a triangle instead of a circle, an open-ended triangle.
A single-ended ray.
Okay. We got a lot of metaphors. Yes. These are ways
better than yours.
These are helpful metaphors.
Can I ask one more question to digress slightly? Did Calvin, you mentioned beauty, and beauty was stated as a fact. Beauty was. Was Calvin's view that beauty is because God created beauty? Therefore, it is beauty, whether or not man recognizes it or not, or is beauty in the eye of the beholder, as far as Calvin is concerned?
No, Calvin would be much closer to the objectivist view that you gave at the beginning.
Yeah.
That beauty reflects the nature of God, and if men don't see it, there's something wrong with them.
Okay.
Rather than, well, every man has his own... Well, every man does have his own concept of beauty. That's the beguiling thing about that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In one sense, that is true. Because mm-hmm. every man does have his own taste. Mm-hmm. And all that.
Right.
But that isn't to say that there isn't an objective norm by which beauty should be measured. Okay, I ask you a question now as we move along. Calvin's next sentence, after we've understood this very telling one about he from whom all things draw their origin, he says, furthermore, if the cause is sought by which he was led once to create all these things and is now moved to preserve them, we shall find that it is his something alone. What is the only cause that we can give for God deciding to create the world? Paula?
His
goodness. Why? And I'm asking that not because I'm leading to an answer, is I'm not sure exactly why Calvin says that. I'm not saying he's wrong. But why do you think Calvin says that the only reason we can give for God creating the world is because he's good?
Because he's the ultimate of good.
Yeah.
Is that
the
kind of answer?
He is.
Because nothing else, I mean, he can't do anything else but good. That's almost like an inverted logic, but
because goodness is voluntary, it shows that it wasn't necessary that God created it.
Yeah, I think that's helpful.
No one is good but God alone.
Yeah.
I think the minister this morning would disagree with that. We talked about Genesis 1-3, and he said God created the earth because it pleased him to do so.
Okay, let's ask this. Is it possible for God to have done something just because it pleased him in such a way as to be either malicious or arbitrary or just to be pursuing idle curiosity?
I mean, void of purpose?
Yeah.
That would presume that we would know God's purpose.
No, we don't have to know what it is. The question is, is it possible that God would do anything without a purpose? And then the next question is, are his purposes ever evil or malevolent? No. And so then we're back to what seems to be, if God chose to create the universe, it must have been because he's a good God.
Hmm. I don't know what that says about the universe being good, though.
Well, if God is good, then he can't do anything which isn't good. And so anything that is made by God would have to be good. You say, no, wait a minute, I know, you know, I'm good, and I sometimes make mistakes when I'm working out in the shop, and I don't... Yeah, but what we'd say is, yes, what you'd understand, though, is the notion of good we're using is that infallibly good means you never fail. And so I may have good intentions and still do bad things, but God is better than that. When we say God is good, everything he makes is good, too. No flub-ups with an eternally good God. Okay? So God couldn't have made a bad universe. Anything that makes a bad universe can't be called good, can't be called God.
How long would it be before we get into discussion of theology?
I think it's chapter 16 that when we come to the providence of God, we'll get into that. It is coming. We have some good, believe me, there's lots of things this year we're going
to
get into.
The creation of evil?
Yeah, how do we justify the ways of God in allowing evil in the universe? Or creating evil? Or predestining evil? Any of these things? Paula?
God's goodness, that means that it has a purpose. That it's purposeful, not just, like you said, just idly or
maliciously. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when God created the universe, it wasn't like, we mustn't ever envision, as, you know, this happens to us, although I must say, in my life, I'm so busy, I don't get much free time that way, but sometimes men can be so idle, they say, what'll I do, you know? And I'm just going to go out to a movie, or I'm going to kick up my heels or cause trouble or get drunk or do something. I mustn't think that God was sitting around saying, well, I tell you, being eternal sure is boring. I think what I'll do is I'll make a universe and see how that goes. You know, no, God wasn't just satisfying idle curiosity. He made the world for a distinct purpose, and it must be a good one. All right, now I'm going to drive home my argument that Calvin doesn't use the evidentialist, neutralist way of argumentation in his apologetics. Section 7 comes to his argument now from God's government and judgment in the affairs of men. He refers to the second kind of God's works outside the ordinary course of nature, where we can find proofs of his powers just as clearly set forth. Second kind of God's works outside the course of nature. When I first read that, I read it and reread it and reread it, trying to figure out, no big deal. What he's saying is, what happens in civil affairs or in human interaction is not part of the natural course of things, because free will or choices and creativity and interaction is